Hey everyone, welcome back to Citywide Blackout, your home for music, movies, and more. I'm your host, Max Bowen. Well, it's been a few years, but Pratik is back. The Boston-based singer-songwriter has been really busy with the release of his debut album, The Band's All Gone, and two great new singles, Wrong and If I Were a Dog. We look at the last year and its impact on the Boston music scene. Pratik talks about a year without shows and how he's moved his creative energies in new directions, including establishing his own Patreon page and doing a number of live stream shows to great success. And folks, he is back. I am joined by friend of the show. It's been a few years, but he is back with a lot to talk about. Boston-based singer-songwriter Pratik joins me. Pratik, dude, it is so great to have you back, man.
Dude, likewise. It's so good to be back after all these years. It's been a long time. Yeah. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm glad, man. I'm glad. And I'm very happy to have you back here. I'm happy to see that you're making new music. And it's such amazing stuff, too. Thanks, content. I want to start with your newest single, Wrong, which was released actually on the day of this recording.
Yes, indeed.
Listened to it a bunch of times. Now, I know that there's a story behind this, the short version being that a woman that you dated years back had said that you were the first non-white guy that she'd ever done anything with.
Yeah.
And this was a thing that you had to deal with for many years. And putting it into words, I guess, sort of helped to process it. So the question I have to you is, why of all the things that you deal with, why was it important for you to have this out there as a song?
No, it's a really good question. I think it's because the thing about music is, you know, self-expression is the idea that, you know, like we, you know, a lot of musicians, you know, will write songs, or painters will paint paintings, or sculptors will make sculptures about, you know, stuff that they're struggling with and stuff that other people are struggling with. And they'll make art about it that attempts to express that struggle in some way. And the thing is that there's a lot of struggles. There's a lot of struggles to make art about. But I think one of the struggles that has been a big part of my life that I've always kept coming back to and that I've never been able to really put into words or put into a song was fitting in. And how being the only brown guy in a lot of really white places, it was a big part of my life. And it was, I walked around feeling like something was off, but I almost took that, I just accepted that as normal, you know, if that makes sense. You know, I went to college, probably like less than 20 Indian people there. You know, I was in high school, probably knew less than like 10 Indian people. Come to Boston, doing stuff in the music scene. No, I know probably less than five other musicians doing, five other Indian musicians running in the same circles that I am, and probably still like less than, you know, maybe less than like 20 Indian people that I just know in the entire city overall. Which is, it's a little bit of a thing. And when you, you know, when you deal with being of a racial minority, it affects every part of your life. And that includes dating. And you're always going to feel, weird and out of place. And that's going to hurt the most in a lot of really unexpected ways and in a lot of really intimate relationships. So I guess the short version is, it's just like, you know, I felt really out of place because for not being white, and I really couldn't run away from that when I was trying to date someone. And so when this woman said that, like, I was the first non-white guy she'd ever hooked up with, that really bothered me for a long time and made me feel just off and weird in ways that that it took me a really long time to express, basically.
Having done the song, written it, put it out there, do you view this experience a little differently now that you've been able to kind of get out what you were feeling?
I don't view it as this evil, malicious thing, if that's what you're asking for. I totally get that, you know, it's something that, because especially because at the time, you know, we were both in college. So like I was 19, this one was 18, and you know, it's like, that is very much something that someone, you know, that someone that age would do. So I don't hold that, you know, I don't hold that against her at all. I think for me, the bigger thing is just suddenly is that I've never been able to talk about this in music. I think maybe even my music, I've tried to avoid or talk around the fact that, you know, I've usually been one of very few non-white people in any usual place that I'm in. So I guess part of the, if I feel differently about anything, it's suddenly I feel that this is actually a conversation I can have with people, you know? But I guess in terms of like making peace with what happened, I think actually even before I released it, I think I started making peace with what happened and accepting that it was, you know, like a part of my life. And accepting that it was, you know, a big part of, a small part of a much larger pattern.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'd like to stick with the subject of your experiences, in high school, college, and living in Boston. The Boston thing surprises me because, I mean, the city is such like a melting pot. There's so many different people from different backgrounds there, but it sounds like you were still kind of the minority within your community.
Absolutely.
Does that come up in your interactions with other musicians? Do they ever ask questions? Do they ever seem curious about like your own background?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I actually don't, I haven't talked about sort of being Indian in Boston with a lot of other white musicians, but I know two other singer-songwriters where we kind of share comparable circles, two other Indian singer-songwriters. Shout out to Ava Sophia, shout out to Steve Chandy. They're both amazing, amazing musicians. And we've definitely talked about it and just feel it's just like, yeah, this is kind of how it is, huh? I think Boston does have a lot of people from a lot of different places. A lot of people of a lot of different backgrounds, but I think that one thing that a lot of people forget is that even so, it's still really white, and especially given how fast it's gentrifying, a lot of non-white people, they're being pushed further and further and further out of the city. So, you know, you're seeing all these sort of, you know, all these condos popping up, all these craft breweries popping up, and you like walk in and you see most of the people who are there, and it's almost always entirely like these young white people. The Boston area, a lot of the surrounding suburbs, yeah, they're pretty diverse, but increasingly the city is becoming way more and more and more homogenous. And that's something that I've really started to notice more and more over the past 5 years, especially in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests, especially as I've started to like think more about my own experiences. So it's a lot.
Yeah. I definitely hear you about the gentrification. For me though, my perspective has been about the change in living, you know, like all of a sudden living in Boston is impossible. I've seen countless friends priced out because they realize they can afford a house before they can afford an apartment, which is insanity.
Boston, yep.
From what you've seen, though, with the changes, has that affected you personally? Do you find that you're now even more of a minority than you were before when you first got to Boston?
I think, that's kind of a funny thing because I've been relatively lucky. I've been able to find like a couple of affordable places to live entirely through luck. I've won the lottery. I've won a figurative lottery literally many times, I guess is the best way to put it. But I guess to answer about, do I feel like even more of a minority? Kind of the sad thing is kind of not, because the singer-songwriter scene in Boston, like a lot of the, you know, like the scene that's really built around, you know, like people with guitars and pianos, like, you know, and going to all the open mics and everything, that is a really white scene. And that's not to rag on anyone, because I love this scene. This scene made me who I am, and I have a lot of friends in it. But it is a pretty homogenous scene. And like I said, I know only two other Indian singer-songwriters who are in that scene, who we share, you know, like who we have mutual friends with, who I've played shows together with. And it's a real shame because, A, there's a lot of Indian people. There's a lot more Indian people in Boston, even though we're, again, still a racial minority. But also there's a lot of really good non-white music scenes in Boston. Like the hip-hop scene in Boston is incredible. But even though Boston is such a small city compared to others, the music scene is really, really segregated and sort of intends to be like, and the singer-songwriter scene especially tends to be like really homogenous. So it's, you know, segregation, you know, that segregated scene, you know, segregated and homogenous. It's a difficult combo. So the sad thing is that even as more and more people of color are getting priced out of Boston, I think kind of day to day, my experience has been the same for better and for worse.
I'd like to stick on the subject of the singer-songwriter scene because I don't think we talked about this last time we had you on the show. When was your introduction to it, and what was your early experiences in terms of like first shows or open mics?
So the very, very first open mic that I ever played was actually, it was out in Natick, so it was pretty far from the city, but it was close to where my parents were living. And that was one where I got introduced to a lot of the, you know, like a lot of the folkies and singer-songwriter types living out in the suburbs. And then I think the first thing that was the first like major open mic that was like really a home for a lot of singer-songwriters that I played was the Lizard Lounge open mic. This would have been coming up on 6 years ago, probably about like 5 and a half now, but like coming up on 6 years ago. So when I played that, I think that was really the open mic that sort of, there were all these singer-songwriter types. There were people who were playing the kind of music that I wanted to play. There were, you know, people that I wanted to be friends with. There were people that I wanted to sing with. I just kind of latched, and there were people that I wanted to perform in front of, and I wanted to say, hey, here's my music. So that was like the first thing that I kind of latched onto. And then I think, and actually, it's a funny thing because through that open mic, the host of that open mic at the time, Tom Bianchi, he also got me my first paying gig playing at the Burren in Somerville, which has become another like really, really, you know, just a meaningful place to me. So I would say it was really like those two places that really kind of made me early on. And then expanding out a little more, getting into, you know, like O'Brien's, the Midway Cafe over in Jamaica Plain, Midway Cafe. And then actually right before the pandemic, I finally got to play at Great Scott. I was so bummed to hear that it closed down and so relieved to hear that they're working on relocating. So just fingers crossed that all works out.
It's definitely been a rough year. That's putting it extremely mildly. But like you said, it's nice to see that some of them are able to find ways of bouncing back. I know Once is doing their virtual stage. I think they are working on finding a new home. Yep. So definitely looking forward to when shows can resume. We can get back out there 100%. Safely and get things going again. Since we brought it up, as someone who is a part of the scene and can see it on that, you know, in-person perspective, how has it been for Boston's musicians?
Do you mean how's it been like over the past few years or just...
Just over the past year. I mean, you know, no shows, no chance to get out and play. Everyone's separated, really.
I'm not going to lie, man. It's weird. And honestly, I'm not sure I can trust myself to, you know, give you like any kind of accurate, honest assessment because I just still feel like I'm kind of in shock and I feel like most days that I've been lucky enough to stay at home and, you know, I'm very, very grateful for that. But at the same time, every, you know, sort of day that I wake up, I still feel kind of just like I'm floating. Like, I'm like, this isn't real, right? This is, this is a joke, right? And, you know, I've been lucky. I try to, you know, I keep busy. You know, I've been writing songs. I've been playing shows. I've been growing my Patreon page. And I'm all very, I'm really grateful. But I guess having said that, I think over the past year, it feels like every night I know on my level, and I think a couple of other musicians would say this too, it feels like every nightmare we have as musicians is kind of coming true at once and blindsiding us all at once. It's just like, you know, we can't play shows, so we're losing most of our income. The clubs can't host shows, so they're losing most of their income, so clubs are closing down en masse. We, you know, we're sort of, you know, like home most of the time, but we can't make money. So there's this sort of, it feels like you're pacing around in a cage a little bit. It's very strange and very surreal. I am really happy about how live streaming, how virtual shows, how all that's enabled us to, you know, keep making music, keep putting our music out there, keep connecting with people. You know, I would say like, I'm still surprised by it, but I think I've managed to even like grow my audience a little bit, and meet, you know, new people and get my music to new people entirely online. And I'm very grateful for that. But even so, it feels like a lot of hits came at once, and I have faith that that the music scene is going to rebuild. But honestly, I couldn't tell you how that's going to happen because so much needs to get rebuilt.
Exactly. Yeah. I've talked to some artists for whom music was their 9 to 5, you know, they did cover gigs, they did weddings.
Exactly.
And that week in March, it was just like, boom, boom, yeah. Boom, boom.
Yeah. It's kind of, that's actually the thing is like, as someone who's, you know, who's also is like, you know, does the 9 to 5 with the cover gigs. I think that's probably some of the closest you can get to like any kind of structure and very self-employed paycheck to paycheck, you know, gig worker type of job. And having all of that get wiped out from under you, having to not knowing where you're going to get your money from, and then, you know, like tangling with unemployment and everything, it's a lot.
It is, definitely. Is there a feeling of hope now, though, that we are seeing some positive direction? Like, people are getting vaccinated. We're talking about a full reopening. Venues are getting guidelines to how they can safely have shows again.
Well, I'm hopeful, but I do really want to be careful. I've known too many people who've lost stuff to the pandemic to, you know, just really to, I guess, rush into reopening stuff. I think now that they're, you know, now that people are getting vaccinated now, and now that the, you know, Massachusetts has started printing out, you know, the vaccination numbers every day. And that's honestly, that's been one of the most inspiring things I've seen in a minute. I didn't think it would be, but it is. I do think that there's reasons to hope, but I guess I want to exercise some caution, encourage people to exercise some caution with reopening, with, you know, trying to get back to normal, because it is going to take a while. It's going to take a long time for people, everyone, to get properly vaccinated, and for the vaccines to become effective. It's going to just take a long time for life to resume as normal, you know? Like, even this past weekend, a friend of mine, her dad died from COVID. And I don't think he was even in his 60s. And the real gut punch is that he actually would have been eligible, I think, like, within the past couple of weeks, he became eligible to get the vaccine. And, yeah. You know, so it's like, it's still, and, you know, I'm still hearing from people who are testing positive for it. So it's just like, we still got to be careful. We have tools. We have, you know, we have strategies. There's, you know, COVID isn't some kind of unknown monster. There are ways to fight it. There are ways to be, you know, there are ways to be safe beyond just staying at home, and taking, you know, sensible precautions. We have actual, you know, we have actual medicine that we can use to fight this disease now. But even so, we still have to be careful. Even if it's not an unknown monster, it's a really scary and a really powerful one. And it will just take. Mm-hmm. That's all it's going to do.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Yeah. Wear your fucking mask. Mm-hmm. Stay home. Keep yourself safe. Check in on people. When your time comes, get your fucking shot. The end.
Yes. Always. Always, always, always.
You've definitely had a busy year. You've released singles. You released an album. You have started a very successful Patreon. You've done a series of live stream cover nights. You've definitely kept it very, very busy as an artist. Two-part question for you. First off, how has that helped you during this past year, you know, being so creative and being so public? And also, how has it helped you to increase the audience?
That's a good question. Well, I think kind of like I was talking about earlier, you know, just like usually, you know, when shows are kind of the usual structure that you build, that, you know, musicians will build their life around, you know, it's the kind of the closest thing you can come to, and, you know, to come to like a 9-to-5, you know, like a very self-employed driven paycheck to paycheck gig worker kind of job. And, you know, now, you know, in 2020, you know, all that just went out the window because, you know, we had to stay safe. So releasing stuff, doing live stream concerts over on my Patreon page, it's given me back some of that structure. And it's really, it's just given me some kind of direction. It's reminded me that, you know, I'm doing this because I love doing it, and B, because there are people who love the way that I do it, you know, so I get to perform for myself and I get to perform for them. And even if it's, you know, through a webcam, you know, it's still performing and it's still something that makes me happy. So yeah, the first thing that it did is, like, you know, is that, you know, putting out all this stuff and, you know, growing stuff on my Patreon page and everything, it's given me back some of that direction that the pandemic's taken away. Now, and as to growing the audience online, I think a lot of it's just kind of been, it's basically been luck in social media. I've been really fortunate over, you know, the past few years of, you know, as a, you know, to get noticed by, you know, more and more press outlets, getting noticed by the Boston Globe, getting noticed by the BMAs. So I will say I feel very fortunate in that way that I had a lot of that going for me, so that even when the pandemic hit, there were people who wanted to, you know, write me up. There were, you know, the folks at the Boston Music Awards, they hit me up in 2020 to do the 617 sessions. That was a tremendous opportunity. So I had a lot of luck going into it. And then I think the other thing that's really been about it is just, you know, social media is, like, I am, for all of its pitfalls and its poisons, I am very, very grateful that at least we have some way of, you know, communicating and checking in with each other and meeting new people too. Social, the ability to meet, like, new people and form meaningful relationships, friendships, romantic friendships. My current partner and I, we actually met online and then found out we had mutual friends. I remember as a kid growing up, it was just like, don't talk to strangers online because, you know, they could be trying to kidnap you. Now, we meet new friends online all the time, you know, just like I could become friends with someone in, like, New Jersey or Pennsylvania through Instagram or Facebook. And then we might end up, you know, we might end up meeting up when it's safe. My partner lives in Boston. We had a ton of mutual musician friends, had no idea that the other existed until the pandemic. We met in a Discord server and then we started chatting and that turned into flirting. I guess, yeah, luck in social media. That's really been how I've been able to grow my audience. And I'm very, very grateful for that.
Okay. So talking about new releases, another recent one was If I Were a Dog. Not going to lie, when I saw that post, I thought, is he being serious here? He's being serious here. I love the song. I absolutely love the song, but...
Thanks, man.
How did this one come about? You know, how, like, what made you think, I want to do a song about me being a dog?
Well, kind of like most songs, I think it really just started, the title popped into my head and I was just like, oh man, this is too good. I gotta do something with this. But I guess, like, the longer story and, like, how everything started building towards that is, like, I love writing sad songs. I like writing, you know, like, about, you know, about the dark stuff, about the ugly stuff, you know, about the really tragically sad stuff. But I've always wanted to write like a write a funny song that has a serious message in it. A lot of amazing musicians that I respect were able to do that. John Prine was able to do that. There's a singer-songwriter favorite that I really love named Joe Pug. He has this really great funny song called "I Don't Work in a Bank," where he just talks about being, you know, just like, I'm a musician, I'm not rich, and it's tremendously funny, but also very, 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 very true. So, you know, seeing all these great singer-songwriters who I respect being able to write these very funny, sort of unserious songs that had, you know, sincere messages in it, that's been something I wanted to do for a while. And I guess it just finally happened.
Is If It Were a Cat ever going to come out?
Quite possibly. My roommates have three cats. We are a cat heavy household, so there's no shortage of inspiration material.
I am very jealous of you because I wish I had that lifestyle.
Dude, it's been so great. Probably that's the other like biggest thing that's been like a lifeline in the pandemic. We have cats. We have snuggly cats. They love cuddles. It's been great.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's perfect, man. Perfect.
Yeah.
Talking though, you mentioned earlier about how a lot of your songs deal with the dark side of life. How do you keep that from getting you down though, where that is the majority of what you sing about?
Well, it's because I sing about it that, you know, helps me to kind of be a happy person, you know, and because my whole idea is that when I get up on stage and I sing these things, I'm talking about these deeply personal things, but the whole goal in like talking about them and singing about them is to make sure that I don't have to live with them and just bottle them up every day. That's another lesson I've really internalized from a lot of these great singer songwriters who sing these like really, really sad songs. Jason Isbell, John Paul White, basically their whole attitude is, you know, just like, they're basically trying to sing these really sad songs so that they don't just have to keep living them over and over and over. Yeah, that's really what I try to do is like, you know, every time I get up on stage, it's like, you know, I might sing sad songs, but that doesn't mean I have to be a sad person. And I've been dealing with, and that's actually been, even as I've been dealing with, you know, like a lot of loss, I really do credit, you know, music and, you know, being able to write the stuff I write and sing the stuff that I sing with really helping me to be a much happier person. Because it's given me an outlet. It's given me a way to feel. It's given me a way to feel seen and to feel heard on my own terms, and that feels empowering and that feels good. So even if I'm singing about sad stuff, it's helping me be a little bit happier off stage. And when other people, you know, come up after the show, you know, people in the audience, and they say, "Hey, man, I really connected with that song. That really meant a lot." It's helping people, you know, people in the audience to be a little bit happier, and that makes me even happier. So, yeah.
When you started in music, did you think that that would be one of your roles, that you would be this sort of support person in a way for the audience?
I had a feeling, but I didn't really understand how much like I would be, just like, and it's kind of, it's funny because this is sort of the goal when you're trying to be a musician. You're trying to, like, when you're trying to be a musician, at least playing original material, you're trying to write these songs that are going to mean a lot to people. But actually seeing how much my songs have meant to people has been mind-blowing. I had a friend who, actually, long before we met, they were listening to one of my songs and it helped them breathe their way out of a panic attack. And hearing that meant a lot. I had a friend who was engaged and his fiance broke off the engagement and he was listening through one of my songs the night it happened and trying to, you know, just, you know, feel his feelings. I've had, you know, people I've never met before in my life have messaged me, you know, like on Twitter, on Instagram, saying it's like, hey, I'm listening, you know, this song and it's really getting me through. So, yeah, I think I might have had some idea, but I was totally unprepared.
How does that make you feel knowing that you get the chance to help some folks through your music?
Really good. I think having all these people, both people I've known for a while who've, you know, watched me, you know, write songs and come to like really love those songs, and also people I've never met who've latched onto my songs and, you know, found a lot of hope and a lot of help in them. It's given me this really tremendous sense of purpose. And I know just going forward, like more than ever, that when I write music, what I want to do is I want my songs to help people in some way. Even if I've never met them, I want my songs to make them feel a little happier, feel a little bit less alone, just really, you know, I want to write useful music, I guess is the best way to put it. And so seeing people's reaction to my music and seeing that they do find it useful, it's given me this like sense of joy and this sense of purpose that is really like no other. It's a really beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. I'm very grateful for it.
I also want to ask about the debut album, The Band's All Gone, which you released back in December. The release method that was so cool. You got to record everything live in front of an audience through Q Division Studios. Mm-hmm. How did all that come about? And when you saw that it was possible, what was your reaction?
Oh, man. Okay. So a couple of things happened. The first kind of bit of background to that was that I'd always wanted to make a live album. A lot of singer-songwriters that I really love, they have these absolutely phenomenal live albums that really, really inspired me. I always loved the idea of, you know, like being up on stage just by myself, you know, my songs and my banter, and being able to capture the audience's reaction to it. So that was something I wanted to do for a long time. And then back in, I want to say it was probably like the, you know, summer, fall-ish of 2019. Yeah, no, it was fall. It was getting into fall. I joked about it on Facebook. And I said, hey, how funny would it be if I did like a solo live album and said it, called it The Band's All Gone? And all these people commented on the post and were just like, dude, you got to do it. And then the engineer who actually engineered that whole live record, a great dude named Colin Lester Fleming, really sweet guy, really talented engineer, got in touch with me the next day on Facebook Messenger. And he's like, hey, dude, I work at Q Division. We do live albums. I can make that happen if you want. I'm like, tell me more. And it was just, after that, it just, you know, it all happened. I went to Q Division. Colin gave me a tour of the space. I started talking, started talking to my manager. We started putting together like, you know, we sat down a date and we started figuring out how we're going to do this, how many people we're going to invite. And then the next thing I know, it's December 2019. I'm playing to like, you know, about like 20 like really devoted friends and fans, on, you know, in the Q Division live room, having an absolute blast. And it all just kind of went from there.
Yeah, I love the energy of that album, especially like your between song banter was hilarious. I absolutely love that one. Were you always that good with the banter, or did that kind of take time to develop?
It took so much time to develop. When I started writing songs, I very naively thought that it was just like, you know, if my songs were good enough, that's all it's going to be. And, you know, you do have to write really, really good songs, especially when, you know, when you're performing primarily solo and you don't have a band backing you up. You do have to write like really compelling songs. But the whole thing is that just like a performance, any kind of musical performance is so much more than, it's so much more than the songs. It's the sights and the sounds. It's the musicians switching instruments. It's the, you know, it's the you know, it's the, you know, like it's like the bassist making jokes while like the guitarist, you know, tunes up, to use an example of like a band and everything. And when you aren't in a band, when you're in, and when you're playing solo, you don't always have that. So, but what you do have is banter. And sometimes that's, you know, deadly serious banter. Sometimes that's stories, and sometimes that's jokes. And so probably sometime around like maybe like 2015, a musician friend of mine who I owe a lot to, who's a real mentor, was talking to me, and he said, "Dude, you sing your songs, but you got to perform them. You're not performing your songs. You really need to perform your songs, because that's what makes them, that's what makes them special. That's what's gonna, you know, you can't just sing." And I was a little bit confused at first, but eventually I started realizing, you know, it's just like, it's, you actually have to be paying attention to the audience, and you have to, and even besides, you know, the songs, as a solo performer, gotta have the banter. You gotta have, you know, you have to be able to talk to the audience. And because in part of that, you're, because that's part of how you connect. And that's part of how you're just like, yeah, I'm not in a studio. I'm up here on stage. We're all here in the same room. And yeah, hey everybody. On top of the actual stories or jokes or whatever, that's a big part of what banter does. It just says, it's like, hey, we're all in the same room. Hi, how you doing? So, and once I had that realization, it just, you know, over, you know, slowly over time, as I started doing more and more shows where I played my own material, I started figuring out banter. I started figuring out jokes. I started figuring out funny ways to introduce songs. I started figuring out serious ways to introduce songs. I started figuring out, you know, how I could, like, you know, like tell a story about a song while I was playing the intro to the song. Something I do when the gang's all gone, you know, it's like, that's a big show moment. Yeah. So it took, you know, it took a long time to develop, but I'm really happy with where it's gotten so far and where I'm hoping to take it.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the most memorable parts was when I think you might have flubbed one of the lines in one of the songs, yeah. But you owned that. You didn't, like, you could have like cut it out. You could have said, okay, that won't make the final cut of the album. No, you kept it in there and you kind of owned it.
Yes. Like forgetting your lyrics, I think that's going to happen to like every singer at least several dozen times in their life, especially if they sing for most of their life. And for me, I think, you know, owning it is the best thing, because it just, you know, it's, I've seen so many amazing famous musicians like flub a line and they just completely own it. And especially when you're just up there with a guitar, you really don't have much of a choice but to do that. I've seen Josh Ritter flub lines, and he's like, you know, like he's now like one of the elder statesmen of folk. Like he's been playing, you know, he's really you know, not only is he really popular, but he's been doing this for like, you know, over 20 years now. And he flubbed a line on when NPR had him for a Tiny Desk concert. And he's just like, yeah. And he's just like, oh, okay. And he laughs it off. And then he goes back and he starts the verse over again. No problem. Yeah, you know, and I was just like, well, okay. If Josh Ritter can do it, I think I can do it. And yeah, it just, on top of that, it's just, you know, it's practical, because the whole thing is just like, yeah, you know, it's just like, I've only got so much time in here, in the studio. I don't want to have to do like multiple takes of everything. And honestly, I think it's kind of fun for the audience, because they get to see that it's just like, oh yeah, this, you know, this guy's songs mean a lot to me, but he's still human. He'll still make mistakes. That's okay.
Yeah. I definitely agree with that. I think you can't run away from that, because everyone screws up. Everyone makes mistakes. And like I said, we're all human, and owning the mistakes shows that, hey, I'm just like you guys.
Yep. The real skill is like, then, you know, I've heard this, you know, from so many people in so many ways about so many different things. And it's always been true. It's just like, the real skill isn't always in avoiding mistakes. It is in avoiding like the very easily preventable ones. That does take that, skill is very much about that, but it's also in recovering from your mistakes. So much of skill is in recovering from your mistakes, especially recovering from stuff that you couldn't have seen coming, or even, you know, even in recovering from small mistakes that, you know, you'd think you'd know better.
that you'd know better than to make.
I was curious about some of the posts you've made to social media in regards to your own struggles with mental illness.
Yeah.
One of the more recent ones, you said that you want people to experience it. You want them to know how it feels to enjoy nothing, for the slightest task to be impossible. I'm curious as to why you want that. Why you want people to kind of experience that part of life.
Well, I guess... So I was pretty angry when I wrote that post, but where a lot of that anger comes from is that I struggle with, you know, ADD, you know, and, you know, and the depression, the anxiety that are sort of related to that. And I think what a lot of people don't get is that a mental illness is not like a bad thought. It's not something you can just push away. It's not something that you can decide doesn't exist. It is very real. You know, it is a physical illness and it has physical symptoms. You will feel exhausted after performing, you know, what seems like a very simple task, like a phone call. You know, you might want to go to bed after just making a simple phone call. You know, you'll have trouble, you know, like you'll have trouble going to sleep. You'll have trouble getting out of bed in the first place. There are these very real, it has very real physical symptoms. And those physical symptoms aren't, you know, sort of distinct from your emotions. They are tied to it. They are tied together. And I think that a lot of people still really don't get that. A lot of people will still say, you know, stuff like, oh, depression, no, it's all in your head. No, it's this really, it's this sadness that's so profound that you don't want to move, you don't want to eat, you don't want to take a shower, you don't want to do the most basic things. And I mean, that all sounds like emotions, because wants are emotions, right? Right, but what, you know, what happens when you haven't taken a shower in like several days? What happens when you've let the dishes go for so long that they're piling up in the sink? What happens when you've been too scared to make an important, when you've been so anxious about making an important phone call that you put it off for weeks and now you can't get it's like an important phone call. Now that person is, you know, like calling you back because they're worried or they're angry. Well, that's the thing. That is a physical symptom, isn't it? Because it's having very tangible effects on your quality of life. Yeah, so that's really about it. It's just mental illness. It really makes life difficult in these ways that you can't appreciate until you've really experienced it.
What have you found works for you in terms of battling these things?
Firstly, professional help. I cannot undersell the importance of professional help and finding like good professional help that works for you. I have been very lucky over the past few years. I've been working with an amazing therapist and I'm on a cocktail of meds that's been working really well. And I can safely say that without either of those things, I would be, you know, struggling much harder. My therapist is able to help me, you know, sort of like, you know, make plans to deal with, you know, difficult things. You know, like I pretty regularly like lose motivation and feel extra sad around winter because as the days get shorter and shorter and shorter, you know, not only do I just feel sadder because I'm, you know, and like, you know, and more bummed that I'm, you know, getting less and less sunlight. It's also easier for me to feel like I've wasted the day because like, oh, it's like, oh, it's 5 o'clock, it's dark. And I haven't done that thing I was going to start. Well, I guess this whole day's wash now. My therapist is, you know, working with my therapist and also, you know, just talking to and as well as talking to other people who struggle with the same thing has helped me deal with strategies, you know, for getting around that, you know, figuring stuff out. It's just like, well, if you still do it at 5 or 6 p.m., I mean, it's still not like you've wasted the whole day. Like you'll still have done it, right? You know, and things like that. And also, you know, helping me, you know, figure out complex emotions. My mom passed away last year. Really glad that my therapist was there for that because she was able to help me make so much sense of, you know,
all the sadness I felt at losing my mom, but also kind of how I'd always had this sense of inevitability because she had cancer and she'd been dealing with it for a very long time. And also how I was dealing with all this anger from not being able to, you know, go see her because the COVID numbers were in her area were really high. So I wasn't able to be with her when she passed. So yeah, one of the biggest things that's helped me with dealing with mental illness has just been professional help. There are people who are trained to deal with these kinds of things. They know how this stuff works, and they can help you figure out tangible strategies and coping mechanisms. And when you find the right people, and oftentimes if you're getting medicated, the right medications, it is really magical. It is night and day. It makes a world of difference. And then the other thing is really just having like a lot of good and supportive people in my life. Most recently, that's been my partner, who also struggles with ADD and sort of the associated depression. And we've been able to develop a lot, and we've been able to, you know, find all these strategies, for, you know, sort of, you know, for dealing with it. We've been able to support each other. I had a really big depressive episode, you know, like a couple of weeks ago, and my partner got onto video chat and just talked to me. And, you know, being able to see their face and being able to, you know, talk to someone who'd gone through these, you know, same kind of emotions, if not for the same reasons, but who understood the feelings, that helped so, so, so much. So yeah, it's, you know, it's get help from professionals, get help from your friends, get help from your family, get real good, meaningful help from everywhere that you can. That's really what it is.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that you're doing better. I really am. It's, you know,
thanks, man.
I think it's definitely true. If you need help, find it. Simple as
yes.
that. There's so many resources out there. Most of them are free. There's hotlines you can call if you're having a real bad spot.
Everything. Yep. The, you know, the crisis text line, crisis hotlines, suicide hotlines, everything like that. Crisis counselors, definitely, you know, having a regular therapist is super helpful. I'm also really lucky because I have a very good relationship with my prescriber. So it's really nice that the person who's giving me meds is able to, is also very sensitively, you know, like address where like my emotions are coming from and not just be like, oh, well, you're feeling X, so I need to prescribe you Y. So I've been really lucky in that. And I highly recommend, like, if you need to get medicated, you know, like definitely find a prescriber that you can have a very good relationship with. But yeah, it's all about help. It's all about being able to accept being helped. It took me a really, really long time to get help, partially because, you know, I tend to procrastinate a lot of things, partially because I think I always had a lot of blocks about accepting help and especially taking meds. But getting professional help was one of the best things I ever did because it actually opened me up to accepting help from my friends and family more often. And now it makes life is so much easier to deal with because not only do I have support, but I know how to ask for support too.
So Pratik, what is next for you? I know that can be a hard question right now, but what's coming down the road for you?
Well, mostly the big thing right now is really, I just want to keep growing my Patreon page. Patreon has been great because I don't just think of it as a way to make money. I think of it as it's almost like a way for my fan club to get involved with my music and to really directly support and directly finance it. I would like, because all the people who have signed up on my Patreon page, they're dedicated fans and they really want to see me succeed. And I'm so grateful for them. And that's kind of, you know, the biggest thing. Really, realistically speaking, I've got some plans for music in the works, but I'm sort of stepping back for a little bit from releasing music constantly and trying to focus on releasing music more slowly, focus on the live streaming shows that I do for my patrons, because that's been just like a real source of joy. So yeah, it's really my Patreon page. If there's a way that you can share a link or something, I'm happy to give that to you, because it's a really cool community. And it's, you know, for as little as like $2 a month, you can become a part of it. And that is money that really helps me. It's going right into buying things like guitar strings and cables and, you know, like putting gas in my car, paying my bills, etc. Yeah.
All right. Well, Pratik, man, this has been a really, really great experience. It's good to catch up with you, to talk about the music, to talk about your personal life, and definitely hoping that this helps some folks listening. I'm hoping that there's some good life lessons for people to kind of take from this. But I really hope that you grow the Patreon page, you get more followers, you get that support, because what you guys do is essential. Very much so.
I appreciate that, man. Thank you.
No problem, dude. No problem. So why don't we wrap this up by getting people the various links, the various socials. Where do they find you? Where do they learn more about you?
Excellent. Okay. So my music's available on most music platforms. So you can find me on Spotify, Apple Music, Google Play, all that. In terms of social media, I'm on Facebook and Instagram a lot. I'm also getting back into Twitter. So my Instagram handle is Pratik Music. My Facebook, if you type in at Pratik Music on Facebook, you'll also find my Facebook page. Twitter is at Pratik _ Music, because, you know, it couldn't just be easy. And lastly, of course, I've talked a lot about it, but is my Patreon page. If you check out my music and you like what I hear and you want to have a direct hand in financing it, it's patreon.com/Pratik Music. I'll make sure to give Max a link so that he can share that. But yeah, those are the things that I'm doing. That's where you can find me and my music. And yeah.
All right, Pratik, man. Thank you once again. Great to hear everything, basically. I know that it seems like a weird wrap up, but it's so great to hear so many good things happening. And I definitely look forward to next time. It will be much sooner.
Yes, man. Thank you so much for having me. And I want to take what you said and throw that back at you. What you're doing is essential, too.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing this.
Hi, this is singer Kate Eppers, and you're listening to Citywide Blackout.
All right, folks, that brings this episode to a close. You can follow the show on Facebook under Citywide Blackout, and Twitter and Instagram under Citywide Max. Listen to the show on Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, and every Saturday at 10 p.m. on Boston Free Radio. To close things out, I've got two of Pratik's singles, All the Stars, followed by The Gang's All Gone. As always, keep those ears open. Say.
pour another drink and think about your wasted youth like a rotting tooth. Summer's gonna leave you stranded, your toes in the pool. Lover's gonna leave before you say you love them too. Counting all the stars in the heavens up above won't tell you how they shine. You're just killing time.
Album was. My brother was living in Kalamazoo, Michigan for a few years ago. And, has anyone here been to Kalamazoo, Michigan? Yeah. I'm sorry. And the thing was, this ties back to my younger brother's friends at the time being idiots. They were in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which is, it's the town that a lot of people in Michigan, pretty much everybody else in Michigan, makes fun of, actually. And, they were having a pretty terrible time. So when you're in a small Midwestern town and you're having a terrible time with your life, pretty much the only thing to do is drink. To excess, to sickness, to death in some cases. And my brother, that sweet, wonderful dude, decided after a couple of years of struggling pretty hard himself, he decided he didn't want any part of that anymore. And that's why the guy you see standing awkwardly in that corner over there is, despite all of it, what he'll probably say in the next couple of minutes, the happiest and best version of himself that I know I've seen. But you know, some of his friends from back then, man. Damn, they were dumb. So this song's about them. It's called The Gang's All Gone.
No one likes you when you're stoned. They just hate to be alone. Not so much they'll take you home. Oh.
No one likes you when you're drunk. You're too big to call a punk. You sail that ship until it sunk. But no one likes you when you're drunk. So find a bar, find a girl, drink your beer, rule the world. Stay up late, drive home high. Forget your job, forget the bills. Run your mouth, chase the thrills. I swear that this is gonna be your year. The gang's all gone and you're still here. No one wants to be like you. Bloodshot eyes and a broken tooth. And growing up is hard to do. But no one wants to be like you. So find a bar, find a girl, drink your beer, rule the world. Stay up late, drive home high. Forget your job, forget the bills. Run your mouth and chase the thrills. I swear that this is gonna be your year. The gang's all gone and you're still here in this town. All you do is drown away from every lifeline you've been thrown. Bottle's not a place to build a home. So find a bar, find a girl, drink your beer, rule the world. Stay up late, drive home high. Forget your job, forget the bills. Run your mouth, chase the thrills. I swear that this is gonna be your year. The gang's all gone and you're still here. You're still here. You're still here. The gang's all gone and you're still here.